The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Chelsea, it's Abram over. Biggest setback featuring a Roman since sending Dad the dick pic in succession. We ask, what's the impact on Chelsea now that it's frozen? Can he still let it go? Meantime, Champions League. PSG trip over second leg again on Mad Night in Madrid. We'll check out all the midweek results and preview the weekend's action too, plus a big, big game in the Intertotally in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Thursday, the 10th of March. Good morning to your listener, or afternoon, or similar. Duncan Alexander, Tom Williams, and Michael Cox on the Totally Today. Hi, everyone.
Hello. Hi, James.
Yeah, hi. Michael's your big day. Your big day. Two-time winner of the Intertotally. Owner of the longest streak in Intertotally history. 14 correct answers in a row. Do you remember that? That was that first season when you got your first ever question wrong in the final and then answered the next 14 to defeat Daniel Story. Do you remember that?
I don't remember it being over 15 questions. That seems quite a marathon
It was
session.
The lockdown. We had a lot of time on our hands.
That explains it, yeah.
Yeah.
Like Spain in the 2010 World Cup, tripped over Switzerland and then just...
Yeah, very similar.
Way to glory.
I mean, the parallels are... Anyway, Story, poor chap, was left shattered, broken. He crashed out in the first round the following year. But he's back today, though. And yeah. That's a treat that awaits us at the end of today's show. Daniel Story against Michael Cox in the Intertotally. Of course, top spot in today's running order goes to the big news Thursday morning of Roman Abramovich sanctioned by the British government. His assets, including Chelsea Football Club, frozen. As you've no doubt seen, they've been given a special licence to continue with football-related activities, but the sale of the club is effectively thus barred. The background to this decision has been widely reported already on Thursday, but in football terms, what it means for the club, they won't be allowed to sell any more tickets. Only season ticket holders can go to games for the foreseeable future, we understand, and no merchandise will be allowed to be sold. The question of player transfers is a tricky one. Apparently that's all frozen, although there's some suggestion that players can be sold, but incoming funds would then be frozen. Catering services will be permitted, but they can't spend more at the club than £20,000 on away game travel, which a lot of people wondering how that's going to work with Champions League.
They're quite lucky to have been drawn with Lille away as it stands. There's a train.
Indeed. Well, to tell us a little bit more about how this works and what it's going to mean for the club, we're joined by Matt Slater of The Athletic. We've seen the news. We're wondering, in practical terms, what it means. So, am I right in saying club sale frozen? They can't sell tickets. Catering can continue. What about player transfers?
Good question. You, me, and everyone else, we're all learning as we go here, right? This is completely uncharted territory for football, for the UK sanctions list, for our rules. We have never had to deal with a sanctioned asset like this before. Normally, it's a warehouse, it's some property. It is not a living, breathing football club that people care about, that has to pay bills, weeks, monthly bills, that is on TV, right? The thing that Chelsea fans, that football, I think, to an extent, have been dreading was announced just after 9 this morning. Abramovich on the sanction list, all UK assets frozen. My word, everything changed from that moment. Now, we also got the terms of a special licence that the football is going to be allowed to operate under. And that is an immediate recognition from the government that Chelsea is different, that this is not your typical sanctioned asset. Now, as you say, we're digesting that. Yeah, the games can go on. They can fulfil their fixtures. They can pay their players. They can pay their staff. Season ticket holders, that's fine. No matchday tickets, no, you can't come. Yes, if you come, you can have a pie and a pint. Anything that's in the club shop now, you can buy it, but that's it. We're not restocking. Chelsea, you can your bank account can receive money from UEFA, Premier League, the TV money. And yes, you can receive your sponsorship income. And yes, you can receive money you're owed for players you've sold. You can't touch it, though. You can receive it. The bank account can take it, but it's frozen.
So how do they... Well, how do they continue to run as a kind of operational business if they can't touch their income?
Whatever they've got in cash in the bank right now, I think. I can't see another way.
But at the same time, if they're granting a special license, and I know we're feeling our way through this because it's unprecedented, if they are granting a special license, presumably all the accommodations necessary to make them effectively still able to continue will be made.
You'd have thought so. I genuinely think that even the UK government are feeling their way through this. It's a sort of temporary license, gets them through to the end of the season. I think the big, big question is the sale, right? Now, the sale was the sort of solves all problems solution, right? Let's just get this in somebody else's hands. Now, the sales process started. We've all written and talked about this Rain Group, this US boutique bank that was overseeing that. We were expecting to hear some news on that next week. Look, no one can pretend that can continue right now, unless we get more clarity from the government about what they're going to do around the license and the sale. So the big issue is, can anyone buy a club from someone who is sanctioned? If there's even a hint of any of the proceeds going to a sanctioned individual, can the government allow that? Can anyone take the risk? And particularly for the kind of people I think that were going to buy the club, Americans, where their sanctions regime is very strict and the fines are huge and no bank, no institution would take on that risk. Can they proceed? Can they possibly sanction themselves, the other type of sanction, a deal with a sanctioned individual? Now, they're going to need a great big green light and a very, very tight set of rules from the government to say, yes, you can. Here's how you do it. The proceeds can't go to him. They effectively go to like an escrow account, or we ring fence it. Da, 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 da. Shares are passed to you. You are now wholly responsible for that club. Away you go. There's not enough detail in the special license for that.
Where do you think, what's your kind of best guess as to where we're going to be, say, in a week's time about this?
Well, I think that has to be the priority number one. So clarity around the sales process. Can you buy this club, and how you do it, and where you pay the money to? Without sorting that out, Chelsea are in a world of trouble this summer. Pretty soon, actually.
Have you any idea how much, I mean, a club like that typically would carry in the bank if they were forced to operate on what they happen to have?
Good question. I mean, you can look at sort of the accounts, which always give you sort of a snapshot of a picture a year or so ago. I actually haven't had a chance yet. For clubs, a lot, they've been carrying more cash in the last year or so, typically because of COVID. So, you know, anything between 20 to 50 million I've seen for Premier League clubs, which, you know, for sort of Chelsea, their wage bill alone is about 30 million a month. So there you go. So it gets them a couple months, maybe if they've got 50, 60 in. But, you know, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable.
All right. Well, big questions about how this is going to impact on the team as well. So many questions. Matt, thank you for being with us to provide some early answers, and good luck with the rest of your digging today.
Thank you. No worries.
Matt Slater of The Athletic. All right, well, look forward to finding out more as that story becomes more concrete. And with that in mind, let's move on next then to the Champions League.
So, Mr. Ranić, what's on your mind?
I'm thinking of opening a toy shop.
Okay.
Yeah, Ronaldo keeps throwing from the Prem his toys. I could make a fortune. And he cost you one as well. Fortunately, with Paddy Power, you know you're always getting the best deals. Like a completely free £5 bet builder on Man United v Spurs this Saturday. Paddy Power!
Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min 2 plus legs. Max 1 free £5 bet per customer. Must have previously deposited to avail. 7-day free bet expiry. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+ begambleaware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Champions League, which was till Thursday morning the big story of the week in football. Not least Real Madrid's extraordinary 3-1 win over Paris Saint-Germain, 3-2 on aggregate, Wednesday night at the Bernabeu. It happened again. Is there a side in football more faithful to their DNA than PSG?
Well, No. That's... I mean, it's a funny question because I understand what you mean, but part of it is that they don't really have a DNA, do they? They are just a collection of individuals. There's nothing tying them together. And yet, even by their standards, it was an extraordinary collapse, considering for the first three quarters of that tie, PSG were completely in control. Kylian Mbappe was almost more influential than the other 21 players put together. And then it just completely transformed. And I mean, personally speaking, I've become slightly sick of the phrase Karim the Dream over the years. But this time, yeah, I couldn't help, you know, thinking of it myself and repeating it to myself because it was just fantastic from Benzema. I mean, to score a hat-trick in that period of time to completely transform the tie. And I think in the end, it was quite deserved. I mean, there were a couple of kind of strange goals, but Real Madrid forced the mistakes. They forced the mistakes with good pressing and shutting down. And Modric was fantastic. And Ancelotti made very good substitutions. So at the end of the day, despite being out of, you know, seemingly out of contention for the majority of the tie, in the end, Real deserved it.
All right.
Lovely image of Michael sitting on the sofa just repeating Karim the Dream to himself. And
in my best Jules impression as well. Right. That I'm not going to do. Here.
Pochettino sitting on the bench muttering Karim the Nightmare. Meanwhile, Madrid papers Thursday morning. Ass, this is Madrid. So there you go. They're another world, say Marca, calling it a crazy and historic comeback. Weirdly, though, I'm almost more curious about, well, it's not that weird, it's pure rubbernecking, but I'm really curious about what the French papers made of this. Tom, you've been all over it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're learning French, it's a great day for brushing up on your disaster-related vocabulary because there is a lot of that around in the sports pages of the French papers today. Flicking through L'Équipe this morning, I found collapse, nightmare, despair, absolute shipwreck, and the conclusion of their editorial was the culture of PSG is the topical. The culture of PSG is the acceptance that the players are bigger than the club and much bigger than the coach. Le Parisien called it the nightmare of Paris. PSG scuttle themselves, another nautical vibe there in Le Figaro. So yeah, lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth as you would expect.
Right, I saw Emmanuel Petit and one of them's calling this worse than that time with Barca 5 years ago when they were 5-3 up on aggregate with 2 minutes left and then conceded those three late goals to go out, but enter infamy at the same time. Why would he say that? Would you agree?
I mean, this has become sort of part of the game now when PSG humiliate themselves in the Champions League is immediately comparing it to previous humiliations to try and establish where it ranks in the league table. I think the thinking behind arguing that what happened last night was the biggest humiliation was that it looked like PSG had put this sort of thing behind them. So albeit with a caveat of playing games behind closed doors, they reached the Champions League final in 2020. They could have won that game, ended up losing to Bayern Munich. They reached the semi-finals last season, going out to Manchester City. And then last summer, they had this absolutely ridiculous transfer window and brought in all these seasoned winners in Leo Messi and Sergio Ramos and Gianluigi Donnarumma and Jorginho Wijnaldum. And there was a feeling that that era of PSG having their trousers pulled down in the Champions League was over. And I think that's why it feels more painful. I mean, if you look at the details, nothing will ever compare to the remontada against Barcelona in 2017, because that you felt that it was on the cards right from the start. And then despite having basically a 3-goal advantage to play with heading into the 88th minute, they still get knocked out. Going out to Manchester United in 2019 was a humiliation, but also a bit of a freak result in the sense that it took, you know, Diogo Dalot slicing a shot and it hitting Kimpembe, you know, on the arm, and you know, Marcus Rashford scoring the penalty. But I think what is particularly painful about last night was it was the sort of thing that PSG thought wouldn't ever happen again. They thought that they were now established as a big club. And I think the fact that we know that Nasser Al-Khelaifi went crying to the match officials after the game, that takes us right back to 2017. That was how PSG explained it. Oh, we were robbed by the referee. This shows that, you know, we're not being treated like a big European club. And so much of what's happened in recent years, you think about PSG's opposition to the Super League, for example. Nasser Al-Khelaifi ends up becoming the new president of the European Club Association. He's best pals with Alexander Seferin. And PSG thought, well, this is it. We've now arrived. The only thing we need to do now is win the Champions League. But we are part of the... we're part of the furniture now in terms of the big European clubs. And so to go out in that manner with not a massively controversial refereeing decision, but, you know, a refereeing decision that could be, you know, that there was a bit contentious perhaps, and having that complete mental collapse once again just takes PSG right back to where they were in 2017. I think that's why it stings so much.
All right. Regarding that Super League business, Filippo Maria Ricci reporting that in the official pre-game lunch, Fiorentina Perez served up two wines priced at €10 each for his French visitors, before then serving up revenge very cold that evening. All right, Michael, you talked about how Real Madrid's press sparked the PSG collapse. Break it down if you want. Mbappe's brilliant goal gave Paris Saint-Germain a two-goal lead on aggregate. Then an even more potentially brilliant third goal was disallowed, but they were absolutely cruising. Duncan, sorry.
I mean, Mbappe kind of scored a hat-trick, didn't he? He had a goal disallowed in the first half, and then that third, or what would have been his third goal if the offside law didn't exist, was the dummy. It was a sort of step-over, Pelé, crossover dummy, and it was very rare you see the entire football world just unite in a sound. You know, the old day-to-day, can you sum it up in a word? No. Can you sum it up in a sound? And it really was like that. It was wonderful, but yeah, it didn't count. And it was, I guess, kind of ironic to see a French striker actually score a legitimate hat-trick down the other end of the pitch. But yeah, I also thought that it was quite sad watching Messi as well. You know, this was the stadium where he put in one of the all-time great Champions League away performances, and that player's gone, really. And he had a couple of runs in the second half, but, you know, just looked off it and, you know, sort of felt sorry for him. And then at the end of the game, saw him in a crisp advert, in the adverts, and I was like, you don't need to do crisp adverts. You know, it's, you don't. You're Lionel Messi, come on.
Maybe he really loves crisps.
Yeah, maybe that's the issue deep down, but I don't think so.
Well, there you go. Mbappe had put Paris Saint-Germain into what looked like a comfortable 2-0 lead on aggregate, and they were pretty much cruising at that point until the press on Gigi Donnarumma sparked the collapse. Michael, so the first goal is Donnarumma's mistake? Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it was aggressive Real Madrid pressing. And I'd also question Marquinhos as well, who kind of just stands in position and lets Benzema block off any potential pass. I think more experienced centre-backs maybe would be sprinting to the edge of their own, but the corner of their own box to get in a position Donnarumma could play the ball to. I must say, I mean, none of them really covered themselves in glory aside from Mbappe, but I thought Marquinhos, who's a captain these days, I thought he was just dreadful almost the whole game. I mean, he made the mistake for the winner as well. I mean, he actually got back in control of that situation and then played an outside of the foot pass across his own box. I mean, he just did so many things wrong the whole game.
In the first half, he tried a little back flick in the penalty box when PSG were well on top, and it almost felt like that was the moment, you know, a very subtle shift in the sort of power dynamic in the game.
He was playing against a team who suddenly hit pretty extraordinary form and few players more than Modric and Benzema. Modric, whose role in the second of the Real Madrid goals was absolutely extraordinary.
I mean, he did everything. He won the ball with the interception. He then drove forward 50 yards over the halfway line and then got the ball back and played a disguised pass through to Benzema. And there was also the moment, I think about 5 minutes beforehand, where he put in a brilliant tackle on Leo Messi. And I think three or four times in the game, he actually made really good tackles. I mean, yeah, for all the talk about Mbappe maybe being, you know, the best player in the world or the next best player in the world, aside from Messi, the only player on the pitch with a Ballon d'Or is Modric, and I think he showed why.
And no sooner had they gone 2-2 on aggregate
Get it in the corner, lads. Come on. I mean, why are you taking a kickoff like that when you've literally gone from 2-0 up in a huge game to 2-2? That is the time, you know, get Mbappe running towards the corner flag, just stick it high. I mean, Michael did a piece, didn't you, about, you know, how teams take kickoffs. And most of them, even the most kind of progressive teams, do sort of generally, you know, go long, don't they? It was just stupid.
It's the most PSG thing ever to concede at a time when the tie is still level within 10.5 seconds of your own kickoff after your captain and centre-back gifts the ball to the most dangerous player in the opposition lineup.
Is it because they just don't deal with that kind of situation enough? And people reference the weakness, the relative weakness of Ligue 1. Is it because they only get into these kind of situations once a year when they usually blow it and then have to start all over again?
I think you have to caveat any sort of observations about the weakness of Ligue 1 by, you know, reminding yourself that PSG didn't win Ligue 1 last season. You know, they came second to Lille. In the last three games, they've lost two matches. They lost 3-1 away at Nantes and they lost away at Nice at the weekend. Nice also knocked them out of the Coupe de France. So it's not like there aren't teams in France who can beat them, who can give them difficult games, but there does seem to be a kind of something about this particular scenario of suddenly having the rug pulled out from beneath their feet in these big gala occasions in the Champions League that seems to just sort of mentally short circuit all their players. And you know, at times like that, you look at the senior players who should respond. I mean, one thing that I thought was curious was that obviously, you know, PSG ended up completely collapsing, but there was a point after Benzema's goal when they were still leading on aggregate, when they knocked the ball around for a couple of minutes, PSG, and looked quite comfortable. And there were players taking the ball in deep positions and you know, playing quite risky passes and doing quite risky dribbles and getting away with it. And you thought, okay, no, actually they have learned. But then as soon as Madrid push again, the whole thing just collapses. And the players who you would expect to be the ones who kind of, you know, restore calm, Marquinhos, Verratti, Kimpembe, etc., are just found wanting.
Indeed. Well, we need to talk a little bit more about Real Madrid, though. And Karim the Dream, Michael. His finish on that third goal, quite extraordinary. He also has moved into third place in their all-time scoring list. He's now behind Raul. He's on 309, Benzema. Raul's on 323. Cristiano Ronaldo, of course, on 451. A great deal of which, or a pretty large number of which, were actually assisted by Benzema himself. He's already equaled last.
I think I might be wrong. Yeah. I think Ronaldo's only on 450.
Oh,
officially.
Really?
451 might be because Marker gave him that goal.
That goal
that actually had no business being his.
All right, we'll call it 450 then. But he's a long way ahead. Benzema, though, has already equaled last season's tally of 30 goals, and he's still got a month or two to go. His best ever haul in a season was 32 goals, and he's only two off that. It's all pretty extraordinary. Does anybody want to eulogise Karim the Dream, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's obviously come into his own in the last few years. I was always slightly unsure about Benzema in the sense that he was really prolific. He was always a very good striker, but his role was always to bring out the best in Ronaldo. And I think that compromised him for what you would generally consider to be his peak years. But I mean, he's coming up to 13 years at Real Madrid now. And I think there's only one season where he's started fewer than 28, 29 league games. So he's been very consistent in terms of just being there, which sounds like a bit of a backhanded compliment. But at Real Madrid, who are always desperate to bring in the next superstar, he's seen off a lot of other players. And I think his last 3 or 4 years have probably been his best. And he was brilliant last night. I mean, probably could have scored another couple. He had a couple of good headed chances. I think it just shows how threatening he is in various situations, because in the end, the tie was kind of just Mbappe against Benzema. And in the end, Benzema won.
Was there any tactical credit to Ancelotti, who we all said got it wrong in Paris? Did he get it right here?
I think he made some good substitutions. I think Camavinga came on for Cruz and was just more mobile, because Cruz is a little bit injured at the moment. Rodrigo came on for Asensio and really hugged the touchline well. He made a very quick change when Carvajal got a booking after a tactical foul on Mbappe, and that meant that Vasquez later on could make his own tactical foul on Mbappe, so that worked out well. And he also made a slight tweak at left back, which I thought was interesting. Didn't really affect the game, but he started with Alaba at centre back and Nacho at left back and switched them late on so that Alaba could offer a little bit more on the overlap. So there was various little things he did, nothing transformative in terms of changing the system, but just subtle things that I think helped to put Real Madrid in control.
He had Everton in the top four at Christmas last season, so his stock really is at an absolute high, I'd say, at the moment.
If Real Madrid do sign Mbappe, does that work? Where would he play?
Well, I guess you'd put him and Vinicius either side of Benzema, and him and Vinicius would have to do rock, paper, scissors for who gets to start on the left, because that's where they would both want to be. But I mean, you can't take Vinicius out of the Real Madrid team because he is A, brilliant, and B, has a really good understanding with Benzema. But then Benzema has kind of got that Harry Kane thing that he can kind of be a number nine and a number 10 all in one. He sort of thinks of himself as a number nine with the soul of a number 10. So you could actually have him in a slightly more withdrawn role, and then Mbappe and Vinicius sort of advance. But I would have thought that'll be the approach if Mbappe goes, which he probably will.
Kind of feel like Wednesday night shifted that on a notch or two. As for PSG, what happens next? Grace Robertson suggesting that it'll be back to the cycle of disappointment and then massive retail therapy and then more disappointment, etc. and so on. Rory Smith, though, positing that maybe this last night marks the end of that kind of golden era for them. Rory says, I'm guessing Qatar's interest in football might change after the World Cup later this year.
There has been a lot of speculation that it has been a project leading up to 2022 and that might wind down afterwards. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, if there's been a missed opportunity for PSG, it was two seasons ago. They got to the Champions League final, and I think they were actually the better side in that final against Bayern Munich and lost it. So for all their collapses, they were one game away from winning the Champions League, and you would think that project is complete. But maybe today is a day of two very grandiose projects coming to an end.
Well, they've given us plenty of thrills and chuckles along the way. And I mean, certainly for anyone apart from Jules and PSG fans, so Wednesday night was pretty spectacular entertainment. Duncan, do you have a final stat on Wednesday night?
Just that it continues to be baffling that Joe Allen has featured in a European final more recently than Lionel Messi. And that might stay the case forever.
The Wells Chavvy, what's baffling about that? It's exactly where he deserves to be.
The chicken farmer extraordinaire.
The man himself.
There were other footballing stories, listener, on Wednesday and Tuesday in the Champions League last 16. We'll be getting onto those next.
Keep listening for Michael Cox versus Daniel Story in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And it's live-ish.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only, get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs, maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds, online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Listener, it's the 10th of March 2022 as we recorded. On this day in 1971... Cardiff City recorded one of the great victories in Welsh football history. Tom Williams, do you remember what it was?
When they beat Real Madrid in the European
Topically
Cup.
Enough, yes, they beat Real Madrid 1-0.
Rhys crowded up, but get away with it. This is dangerous. Clark! Yes! I'm absolutely deafened by this huge crowd.
Brian Clark's headed goal in front of a crowd of nearly 50,000 people at Ninian Park. This was in the European Cup Winners' Cup quarterfinal first leg. Sadly, Cardiff City, who this week will be playing at against Preston North End, lost the return leg 2-0 at the Bernabeu. So similar to the Paris Saint-Germain paradigm, really. Real went on to reach the final in 71, where they lost to Chelsea. Speaking of dates, here's one if you fancy watching Michael and Duncan in an on-stage act, possibly involving a feather boa. Details to be confirmed. It's the Totally Football Show Live, which will be taking place in Manchester on the 19th of April at the Lowry. Head to thelowry.com for tickets. Rory Smith also on the bill. Totally Football League Show is out on Thursday. Shout out to Millwall, who drew 0-0 at Blackburn in the Championship on Tuesday without having a single shot, despite having 11 men for the entire game. Ending their excellent run of form, Millwall. Anyway,
well, you, I'd say getting a point when you haven't had a shot is good form, to be fair.
Fair. All right, anyway, you can hear that and other things discussed in the Totally Football League Show now. For us, Champions League Wednesday, Man City had a 0-0 draw with Sporting, hearing reports that Scott Carson came on in that game.
Second appearance in the Champions League.
How long between the two appearances?
About 19 years, so just the 265 goals from Ronaldo and Messi in between his two appearances.
Crikey. That was Wednesday anyway, City going through 5-0 on aggregate. On Tuesday, you had a whopping win for Bayern, 7-1 against Red Bull Salzburg, while Liverpool lost at home to Inter, but went through a 2-1 after their victory away in the away leg. Hey, Bayern's 7-1 win over Salzburg. Robert Lewandowski with something to say to all the folk busy hailing Benzema as the greatest number nine around. He got a hat-trick as well, although two admittedly were penalties. But, I mean, he just scores so many goals. If you were building a club, which would you have, Benzema or Lewandowski?
I'd have Lewandowski.
Good question.
I'd have Lewandowski.
Have Lewandowski.
Everyone's going with Lewandowski.
Question marks about Benzema and his professionalism and past conduct.
I don't think there are questions about his professionalism. I think there are questions about some of his off-field alliances, shall we say.
Right.
And just on the Lewandowski hat-trick and the two penalties, I was impressed that he took two very different kinds of penalty, in that the first one was a kind of goalie independent one where he just didn't even look at the keeper, slammed it bottom left. And then the second one was a sort of Jorginho-style goalie-dependent one where he waited for the goalie to move and then tucked it away. Just mixing things up.
Yeah, very nice. To think we thought that maybe there was a chance of an upset in that game after the 1-1 in the first leg. Anyway, Tuesday night, again, we thought there wasn't much hope of an upset in a Liverpool hosting Inter. Very nearly, or there was certainly the strong possibility of one in the second half after Lautaro Martinez's absolute screamer an hour in. Any thoughts on this game?
Well, it was slightly frustrating because obviously the red card came about a minute after that, and it did look as if we were heading for a real grandstand finish, and Inter kind of died a little bit after that. I also wasn't that convinced by some of Inzaghi's changes. I thought they kind of, they didn't really increase the momentum. I mean, Liverpool missed lots of chances here and probably could have been home and dry. But overall, I was quite impressed with Inter over the two games. I think they probably slightly unlucky to lose 2-0 in the first game and maybe a bit flattered by the 1-0 win here. But overall, a really good tie, I thought.
I was quite struck by the officiating in this game, in that the referee was Mateo Lajoz, who is a well-known Spanish referee, bit of a Mike Dean vibe. And he let an awful lot go in terms of like physical challenges. And there were sequences that recalled the sort of videos you see on those, you know, football was better in the 80s Twitter accounts, where you get like a crescendo of knee-high and hip-high challenges, and then someone gets like studded in the face, and it's like, well, we draw the line at that. I felt like he seemed to want to let the game go as far as he possibly could. And it was kind of, there were points where you thought he might lose control of this. And then suddenly, with about half an hour to go, it was like, actually, no, this has gone too far. I'm going to start getting the cards out. And I mean, I think Sanchez deserved to be sent off. Could have had a straight red, just for that one challenge. But it was, it was curious. And again, in the Man City game last night, there was an awful lot that the referee just allowed to go. At one point, Gabriel Jesus is sort of shaping to shoot in the penalty area, gets flattened, play on. He was tripped outside the penalty area at one point. Quite blatant fouls, play on. And it kind of feels like this, you know, this kind of instruction to referees to kind of let the game go a little bit. I mean, I can understand the thinking behind that, and it kind of, you know, it makes for less stop-start matches, but it's difficult to police because you look at things that some referees will allow and you know, in this sort of VAR age, and it's hard to understand why certain challenges aren't being picked up on.
Mm. Well, indeed. Anyway, Liverpool go through. Inter go home with their heads held high. Gazzetta saying, worthy of Inter. That was their big headline on Wednesday morning. The feeling that they demonstrated that they weren't that far off a team that were European champions not too long ago. Certainly becoming the first team to win at Anfield since, Fulham. Just over a year ago.
Because if people are counting Liverpool's draw in the League Cup final as a win, as a run of 12 wins, then the fact Liverpool got through this tie means that they must have won this game, right? Because that's how it works.
Fair enough, Duncan. I'm not going to argue with you. Not on the listeners' time, anyway. I did notice Jurgen Klopp's description of 2-0 as the most dangerous lead. He said 2-0 is the lead that has been turned over most often in football if you are half-time and two up. and you think you're already through, then you're already on the wrong path. He's just saying, Duncan, whatever the numbers may tell you, that the soul of football says 2-0, red flags
ahoy. He's
literally
got through to the quarterfinals because they won 2-0. So
yeah, but that's
big old rethink this week.
It wasn't harder for them to play against 10 men, though, was it? It was actually easier to play against 10 men, as you would expect. So mixed night.
And the famous Anfield atmosphere didn't help Liverpool to a goal, so it was a massive debunking.
Was it? Okay. There you go. Liverpool will be in the draw, which will be taking place Friday week. Somewhere nice, no doubt. Should mention, just on the subject of Europe, that did you spot there were two Europa League games that snuck in on Wednesday as well? Interesting results. Well, Eintracht Frankfurt, 2-1 winners away at Betis of Seville. While Lyon, Tom, how about this for a result? Going to Porto, where very few teams win, apart from Man City and Liverpool, but other teams don't. And they got a 1-0 victory. Crikey.
Yeah, really big win for Lyon, who have been having a very uneven season domestically. They've got Peter Bosz, the Dutch coach, in charge there, and he hasn't always managed to get his ideas across all that successfully. So they're really struggling to get into the top three in Ligue 1. But they've been brilliant in the Europa League, topped their group. And have reinforced quite well in January. Obviously, Tanguy Ndombele is back there. They brought in Romain Feb from Brest, who started well. Impressive, winning away at Porto. I mean, it would be very Lyon to then, you know, lose the return leg. But, yeah, a pretty impressive victory.
All right, well, next up, listener, let's get on to the Premier League, which has got a busy schedule ahead, 4 games on Thursday night and then all the stuff on the weekend. Our thoughts next.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Yeah, Premier League. If you're hanging around for the Intertotally Michael Cox-Daniel Sturridge matchup, that's not far away now. Let's whiz through these previews and we can get the quiz on. 4 games Thursday night. Norwich against Chelsea, and suddenly not so massive Chelsea news. Reece James has been ruled out of their next 4 games with a hamstring injury. Also Thursday, Saints, Newcastle, Wolves, Watford, Leeds, Aston Villa. Perhaps they've already happened, listener. wonder how they went.
It's very confusing because one's from match day 19, one's from match day 20, one's from match day 21, and one's from match day 30. And those four numbers have a 75% correlation with the names of Adele's four albums.
Is that right?
That is good.
Wow.
Anyone with knowledge of Adele's discography, feel free to make a football-related... No? Nothing that...
No, I was just thinking
go easy on me and Duncan Coxie with your amazing Adele stats.
Nice, nice.
Is that the name of a song? Go easy on me.
I just really rapidly Googled it, obviously not knowing the names of any Adele songs.
All right. Well, you know someone like
For
you...
me, if someone says to me, think of Adele classic, I think of probably one of Matthew Letizia's girls, I reckon. So.
I'm surprised it wasn't a laptop reference, Duncan. Right. This weekend, Brighton-Liverpool. Keep it together, people. Let's not PSG at this point. Brighton-Liverpool, 12:30. It's one of only three games on Saturday. At 3 o'clock, you've got Brentford-Burnley, and that's it for 3 o'clock.
Game's gone, isn't it?
It has, yeah. Well, the 5:30 kickoff is Man United against Spurs. Ooh. Sunday, traditionalists will love five games in the time-honoured Sunday 2pm slot. You've got Chelsea-Newcastle, Leeds-Norwich, West Ham-Villa, Saints-Watford and Everton, who've been taken apart since our last show by Spurs, hosting Wolves. Sunday at 4:30, Arsenal-Leicester. And then Monday, Palace-Man City. Woo! All right. Lots to discuss, not least the two teams involved in Monday night's Tottenham 5, Everton 0. Affair. Tottenham, for their part, will be at Man United, as I mentioned, Saturday tea time. Is this the they should swap managers Clasico?
I mean, quite possibly, yeah. I mean, maybe the result will determine that. But I suppose, as ever with Tottenham, it will depend on which Tottenham team turns up. If it's the team that thrashed Everton and Leeds, you can see them causing United some problems.
But if it's the team that crashed out of the FA Cup against Borough, not so much.
Yeah,
I hear you.
Well,
let's talk about the Tottenham that did Everton to the tune of five goals on Monday night. I missed this as I was busy not winning at the SJA Awards. some Sky retro podcast thing to answer your question.
I'd never heard of that podcast.
Have you not? Right.
It's
niche, probably.
It is quite. I've been on it.
Tom.
But
thanks,
only because they do like sort of kind of in-depth podcasts about, I think it's like cult heroes from Premier League clubs, and they did one on Dimitri Payet, so I sort of talked about.
I did try to do a Kanye, but the on-stage security was a little bit... So what I did glean from the highlights and reading about the Spurs-Everton game was that Doherty had an absolute stormer, and obviously Harry Kane was pretty amazing.
That's basically it. Matt Doherty just pulled out a performance for the ages. It was incredible.
What was so special about it, Duncan?
Well, he was playing wing back, but he was almost doing a kind of Trent Alexander-Arnold pushed into midfield. His pass for Harry Kane's second goal was just a delicious kind of lofted pass that Kane finished brilliantly with his left foot, which now takes him to 38 left-footed goals, which means that he is the second highest scoring player in Premier League history with his weaker foot behind Robin van Persie.
So, sorry, no, he's not the second highest scorer in Premier League history with his weaker foot. He's second highest scorer of goals with your wrong foot. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So van Persie scored 39 with his chocolate right leg, and Kane's on 38 with his presumably not chocolate left leg. But it was Spurs played very well, and I thought, you know, Betancur came back in, was good, but Everton were just really, really bad. Everton, they're looking like a team that's in free fall to me.
Mm. Well, we recall your prediction the other day, Duncan, about relegation. We'll come back to Everton a bit later on when we look at the picture down the bottom end. But with this Doherty role, do you think that's going to be repeated in the game at Old Trafford? How do you feel about Spurs' chances of racking up yet more goals away at Man United, a United team reeling from that 4-1 derby defeat last weekend?
Yeah, I'm interested in the Doherty thing, because when you look at his performances with Wolves, where he did very well, particularly in his first season, He wasn't really playing as like a conventional wing-back. He wasn't overlapping and crossing. A lot of his game was about playing 1-2s with Jimenez and Jota and popping up in central positions. So I'm a little bit surprised why it's taken a while for him to be kind of redeployed in this role. But he's been very good. I think Kulusevski as well has been an excellent signing. I always quite like the look of him at Juventus, but didn't expect for him to settle quite so well. But I think he's done well because he can kind of draw wide and that allows Totti inside. But yeah, I mean, if you take the performances from last weekend, you'd have Tottenham fairly surefire favourites at Old Trafford this weekend, which isn't the case if you look at the odds and the rest of it. But I think Tottenham on their day are very good and seem to be better against better opposition. I think they could cause real problems, particularly with those counter-attacks that aren't quite counter-attacks, you know, when they play out from the back and shift through the lines very quickly. I think I'd have them favourites to win at Manchester United personally.
OK, well, they certainly did get a win last season. Do you remember what the score was?
6-1.
Yeah. Although since then, United have beaten Spurs 3-0. That was at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium back in October. It was the result which brought Nuno Espirito Santo's reign at Spurs to an end. All right, so Michael's got Spurs down for the win. Tom and Duncan?
Well, I'd quite like Ralph Rangnick to say, lads, it's Tottenham in the dressing room. See if that works. This fixture was it's the Pedro Mendes game, isn't it? Remember when he scored that goal? It went about a yard over the line and Roy Carroll scooped it out and the ref was like, yeah, that's good enough for me. So, yeah, I mean, something like that would be good. But yeah, I agree with Michael. I think Spurs, you know, they're looking pretty good and United aren't. So, yeah, Tottenham as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that Spurs have got a lot of attributes that are liable to cause United problems in that they generally sit quite deep when they're defending, which is something that United struggle with, and they're very good and very fast on the counter-attack, and Manchester United are very bad at defending against that sort of thing. So, I think it could be a tricky one for United.
Could be a massive game, this, for the top four race, which currently has Man United in fifth, just a point behind Arsenal, but the Gunners have three games in hand on them. United, meanwhile, Man United are 2 points above West Ham. Spurs lie down in seventh, but they have two games in hand on United, and they're only 3 points off Arsenal. So victory here, depending on what happens with the Gunners, could see them even move back into the top four, I think, with my maths. Arsenal, if you're curious, this weekend are hosting Leicester. Hey, Michael, we had Daniel Storey on Monday. Once again, going down the Arsenal they've definitely turned the corner. They will finish top four route after they'd beaten Czech's notes Watford. Are you on board with this now, or are you still waiting for, say, maybe their game against Liverpool next Wednesday for a bit more of a reality check?
Well, they haven't got results against the big teams so far this season. They've lost quite heavily to Manchester City and Liverpool. So maybe that is a factor, but...
How would you categorise a game against Leicester? Would that be...
Well, I mean, I think Leicester have won the last two, haven't they? But they're not a good team at the moment. So, I mean, they're a mid-table side by definition. I mean, I think with the points on the board and the games in hand, Arsenal are quite strong favourites now. But there's a few of interesting... I mean, they've still got to play Manchester United. They've still got to play Tottenham. Obviously, those two are playing each other this weekend. So there's a few games that could produce big swings. But I think you have to say Arsenal are favourites at the moment, yeah.
Excellent. All right. Leicester, though, visiting at the weekend. The reverse fixture saw that man of the match display from Aaron Ramsdale. One of the saves of the season on that James Maddison free kick. On the subject of Leicester, Duncan, this is the first time you've been on since Jamie Vardy returned and reached double figures.
That's right, yeah.
In a manner predicted by some, brackets D. Alexander, close well, brackets, would never happen.
Well, I think if we remember after we started the season very well and, you know...
You can't do that.
I raised it to 11.
You can't do that. A prediction is a prediction. You can't adjust
it. It's like the Bank of England and interest rates. No, it's not.
Those aren't predictions.
Committee. No, they raised it to 11.
Yes.
And it's still
because
on.
You can raise lots of things, but not predictions. You're back in 11, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know what? He's just gone and got injured again. So.
No further questions?
I know it's not like news that Jamie Vardy came up from the lower leagues, but I was looking at his stats the other day, and it's absolutely mad that he's won the... the seventh tier, the fifth tier, the second tier, and then the top tier in order. I mean,
wow.
That is ludicrous. We will never see that happen again. Genuinely extraordinary.
What happened to the third and the sixth?
Well, he moved from moved from the conference to.
Would that trouble you? If you were Jamie Vardy, would you feel like I might join a League One team and then a National League North stroke South?
Maybe. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. A question that only he can answer.
It's not too late for him. That could be his sort of, you know, post Leicester objective.
Shout out to Tony Cotty, the last player to play in all four divisions in the same season, 2000-2001.
How did he do that?
He was at Leicester, played for them in the Premier League. He played for Millwall in League One.
So when did he move?
Well, this is pre-transfer.
Yeah, so you could move about. So he was on loan at a few clubs. I can't remember who he played for in the second tier, but yeah, he pretty good effort.
And he disguised himself as well, James, so it wasn't immediately obvious that it was Tony Cotty.
Who's this Antonio Cotte? Yeah. Seems good.
Because there's a Coutinho out there now. You don't think...
Uh-oh. Yeah.
Anyway, West Ham... Didn't mention them in there. I mean, I kind of did peripherally. They're sort of in there if they got their act together. They've got Aston Villa at the weekend. Plenty of football still to be played. A win there. Who knows? They've also got Sevilla away on Thursday evening.
From tough Sevilla to the Villa.
Nice.
Hmm. I wasn't going to say they've started to stutter, but they've been stuttering for a little while, haven't they, West Ham? What is it? One win in four, I think, in the league. And Villa flying off the back of that. Surprisingly one-sided 4-0 win over Southampton at the weekend. And I think we mentioned this before the season started, the fact that West Ham would have to juggle the Premier League and the Europa League despite having not really added too many players to their squad. And in the first part of the season, they were able to do that pretty well. But I think, you know, now they're really getting down to the nitty-gritty, and particularly playing, you know, a team like Sevilla with all their Europa League pedigree, you sort of wonder whether that will become a factor again. And I think when you look at how that top four race is likely to pan out over the last, you know, sort of 9-10 games of the season, it's hard. I mean, you know, it could happen, but for me I find it hard to see West Ham suddenly finding a second wind out of nowhere and really putting a challenge up against, you know, your Arsenals and your Uniteds and your Tottenhams, etc.
Clip that one up, producer Charlie. Who knows when that will come in handy. All right, that's enough about the top four. Next up, let's talk about the bottom three and the teams in and around the bottom three.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Recently on The Totally Football Show, Duncan's big prediction, backed by all the immense processing power of Opta, stroke the analyst, was that current bottom three, Burnley, Watford and Norwich, would actually all stay up. How about that for a twist, listener? With Leeds, Everton and Brentford, the unfortunate sides that would go down in their stead. Duncan, you just pulled a face as I reminded you of that. Your thoughts now?
I still believe it 100%.
All right, yeah. You don't want to raise that prediction. The Everton bit...
part of the Jamie Vardy Bank of England situation, so I can't change it. So.
Okay. But the Everton bit, you don't look that misguided on. They are currently 1 point above Burnley, although they do have a game in hand on them, and two on the other two bottom three sides, Watford and the other team. Oh, Norwich, that's right. Yeah, anyway, so Everton are hosting Wolves on Sunday. Tom, you were mentioning Everton's performance away at Spurs on Monday. What has happened to them?
I think one thing that stood out in that Tottenham game was just how badly they defend. They've got lots of players who are having really poor runs of personal form. You think about Michael Keane, who scored the own goal.
What an own goal.
A heck of an... I mean, an own goal for the ages, right off the laces, having also been at fault for the goal against Man City, where Everton had held out quite well and then end up falling behind. And yeah, they just look very, very sort of shaky. And I think for all the kind of new manager impetus that Frank Lampard has brought with him, there's only so much that can achieve when you've got a bunch of players who've kind of forgotten how to defend. I think it's probably worth highlighting the absence of Yerry Mina as well, who I tend to think of as being quite a comedic character, in that he's forever just sort of wading into you know, bits of aggro that he has no business being involved in. But as a football player, he is a very handy defender, not least, you know, defending set pieces, etc.
I think the fact that
he's been out of late has probably been quite an important factor in Everton's defensive struggles.
I thought their problem against, they started quite well against Tottenham, but they're one of these teams who, it's a bit like Manchester United away at Manchester City last weekend. They started really well because they were pressing quite energetically, and then they couldn't sustain it. And people almost act like, well, this is a big mystery why that's happened. Well, I mean, it's not, is it? I mean, if you put Usain Bolt...
just run out of puff?
Well, if you put Usain Bolt in the 800 metres and say, run your usual race, and he's leading after 200, but it's nowhere 800, people wouldn't say, how on earth did that happen?
He can't make it against Soccer Aid, so...
Well, that's an interesting and illuminating analogy, Michael. Duncan, can we have a stat about Everton?
Yeah, it's March the 10th, which quite late in the football season. Everton are still only 4 points ahead of what Liverpool picked up in their Champions League group stage. So, yeah, it's not a classic season for the blue half of that city.
Wow. They're only a point above Burnley, as I mentioned, with over 10 games to go. They've been a top division side since 1954. It couldn't, could it? ...
It's always quite exciting, isn't it? Like an Everton last day relegation scramble. I'm sure that takes us all back to our respective childhoods. And I think it, just having one of those every now and again is good for the soul. Probably, you know, not for the Everton fans' souls.
I mean, as much. If they did go down, it would be the biggest relegation since...
Leeds?
No, I'd say bigger than that because of the
bigger.
I think you'd probably have to go to the '70s and be when Spurs and Man United went down in that decade. I think it'd be up there with that.
Crikey! Well, three defeats in a row for them. Also for Wolves, at least it was three defeats in a row for Wolves before they took on Watford this Thursday evening. There's a chance it's changed since then. Well, maybe not. Football, who knows? Anyway, there you go. The other teams involved in the relegation battle, Watford themselves, post the Wolves game Thursday night, will be away at Southampton. They haven't won... although they've won one of their last 15 meetings with Saints. Leeds, who are only two above the drop, host Norwich. While Brentford, who may be out of trouble now, they're 6 points clear, host Burnley.
That's a big game, isn't it?
Brentford were the first team to lose to Burnley this season. No team in English League football has won fewer games this season, though, than Burnley. That was one of only three victories they've had the reverse fixture.
That reverse game was quite interesting because you think of Brentford as being relatively old school in terms of aerial battles and that kind of thing. So I thought that game might suit them, but they just got completely battered by long balls up to Chris Wood, who obviously won't be around this time. But Duncan's favourite, Weghorst, will be playing a similar role, I imagine.
I think, as ever with Burnley, there's always an expectation that at some point they'll kind of click back into gear and they'll... you know, rediscover the formula that's led them to safety for what feels like the last, 25 seasons. But that little upturn they had a few weeks back when they won at Brighton, won at home to Spurs, has now given way to quite one-sided defeats. That game against the home game against Leicester they lost recently felt quite pivotal because they went into that with a little bit of momentum. Weghorst had made a successful start to life at Burnley and then lost to two quite late goals. Obviously got stuffed by Chelsea at the weekend. And the thought of them sort of confidently striding out of the relegation zone doesn't seem quite as likely, I wouldn't say, as it did a few weeks back.
Well, both those last two games you mentioned, they were 0-0 at half-time. So maybe Sean Dyche needs to revamp his half-time speech.
Very possibly. Three other games that are taking place this weekend, and they're quite big. Chelsea-Newcastle, that's Sunday at 2. Newcastle haven't won at Stamford Bridge since that extraordinary game, do you remember, in 2012 when Pape Cissé scored a very unexpected brace.
I think that's my favourite Premier League goal of all time.
Cissé! Oh, that is sensational! Pape Cissé with another blinding strike!
Oh, it was also, by the way, I saw this week, it was the anniversary of the Ronaldinho goal that Tom doesn't rate.
Yep, saw it. All plastered all over my Twitter timeline the other day.
How did he score? Williams simply doesn't care.
The toe poke, James.
The Chelsea one, right.
The inelegant Chelsea toe poke.
All right. Brighton-Liverpool also taking place. That, in fact, is the early game on Saturday. Brighton on a run of four straight defeats. And Palace hosting Man City, who you remember they beat back in October at the Etihad. Do you see any changes to the six-point margin at the top of the table? Just throw this in before we get onto the Inter totally.
No. Okay. Although Palace are generally City's mini bogey team, aren't they, in the Premier League? Obviously, in the all or nothing, they dropped points away at Palace that season, and the producers had to kind of put some jeopardy in. They're down to 16 points lead. It's a crisis. But a couple of things to look out for in the Brighton-Liverpool game. Liverpool on 1,998 Premier League goals, so they'll be the second team to reach 2,000 after, obviously, Manchester United. If they do it, and they're only 35 offsides provoked, that old chestnut, short of the record for recorded Premier League history. So that offside line is in its pomp.
And who holds that record, Duncan?
Well, the record is held by two teams in 2011-12, the heyday of the modern offside, and it's Arsenal, which is not that surprising, we think, and Bolton that season, managed by Michael Cox's friend Owen Coyle.
Indeed.
It's quite interesting because I think of offsides being given a little bit less now, what with the kind of let the game flow and if it's, you know.
Surely the introduction of VAR has massively increased the number of offsides detected by our techno-aided friends.
I'm not sure because if they're marginally offside, the linesman will keep his flag down. Yeah. And then if there's a cross into the box and the keeper gets it, then they'll just say, well, play on, that kind of thing. Whereas back in the day, you would have been flagged. I could be wrong, but
no, you're probably
right. I think generally you're right, but Liverpool are exponents of the system. So,
okay, I'm going to tear us away from this discussion about offsides because that is the Premier League weekend, which of course we'll be reacting to on Monday when the games have actually happened, and we've got something to talk about. Next up, it's, I'm going to call it, the most eagerly awaited matchup of the Inter Totally Cup so far. So the quarterfinal lineup taking shape in the Inter Totally Cup. On one side of the draw, Benji Lagnado is through to face Julien Laurens, whilst Dom Fifield awaits his opponent from the matchup between Horn and Charlie Eccleshare, which will be coming up on Monday. On the other side of the bracket, Duncan will be up against Lindsay Hooper, while Flo Lloyd-Hughes will meet the winner of today's clash. And let's find out who's in that.
Up first, he is the quiz king of Kingston, the reigning, defending, two-time Inter Totally champion of the world, Michael Cox.
All right, Michael Cox, champion in the house, everybody. Woo! All right, Michael.
Big build-up, that.
It is a big build-up.
What are those two stars on your T-shirt? Oh, right, yeah.
Michael, two-time winner of the Inter Totally. When was the last time you didn't win a quiz?
Well, probably one of the many, many, many Zoom quizzes I participated in 2 years ago, I suspect. But,
All right. Well, listener Michael is doing this one on Zoom. So, just saying, you know, the precedent's there. The closest anyone's come to beating Michael in the Inter Totally in the two editions so far was last year's semi-final when Sasha took him to a tiebreak. Although, Tom Williams, you had a 3-2 against him early on. All right. Anyway, not infallible, but pretty amazing, as we mentioned, that 14-question correct answering streak, which is a record in Inter Totally. Who's he going to be up against? Let's find out.
And his opponent, the ultimate warrior, the Archdeacon of Doubt, but he just can't get enough of that Inter Totally stuff. It's Daniel Storey.
Daniel, welcome again to the Inter Totally Cup. Woohoo!
Thank you very much. Slightly more understated build-up, I'd say.
Well, it's all in the answers. I mean, the build-up is swiftly forgotten once the answers start, the questions start flying. You were runner-up to Coxey in the first ever Inter Totally final. How much have you been looking forward to this rematch?
Yeah, not so much. Although, Yeah, there's no shame in losing to Michael, and that's what I'll tell myself for the next 2 weeks.
As soon as the draw was published, I texted Daniel saying, I think there should be a seeding system. Because it's a draw neither of us wanted.
Right. Okay, well, finalists in the first into Totally. Then last season, you just couldn't get enough correct answers and went out in the opening game.
It's a good job I've got a sort of steel reinforced confidence about this, Jimbo.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Which Daniel story are we seeing today, do you think?
We shall see.
The winner, whoever that might be, will progress to the quarterfinals, of course, and a date with Flo Lloyd Hughes. They also win £10, which Paddy Power will place on the bet of your choice. The winnings going to the charity of your choice. Daniel, what is your charity?
The Chossall Trust, which is a food bank charity.
Excellent. And what will your bet be?
I've chosen a short-term one, Gabriel to score for Arsenal against Leicester this weekend.
Interesting. Michael, your charity?
I'm doing it for Prostate Cancer UK, and my bet is Tottenham to win at Manchester United this weekend.
I see. Very good. All right, listener, let's get the questions going. Michael, you're up first. Question one. To which player does this career path belong? Villarreal, Recreativo Huelva, Malaga, Arsenal, Villarreal, Al Sadd?
Santi Cazorla.
Is correct. Question two. Clarence Seedorf ended his playing career at which Brazilian club?
Ooh. First name that came to mind was Botafogo. I don't know why. Yeah, I'll go for Botafogo.
Is correct, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Is correct. Question three. From which English team did David Platt move to Italy from?
Ooh, good question. I think this is my final answer. I think it's Villa. Is it Crewe? Is it Man United? Yeah, I think Villa.
Is a good answer. 3 out of 3 for the reigning champ. Question four. What did the Champions League finals of 2000, 2003, 2008, 2014, 2016... 2019 and 2021 have in common, apart from brackets and incident with a pigeon?
They were played between teams from the same country.
Is correct. Question five, then, for a perfect score. Russell Martin is the manager of which championship club?
My championship knowledge is bad. I think it's MK Dons.
You think wrong, Michael. You think wrong. It was
glimmer of
it
hope.
Was Daniel. What do you want to give him the answer?
It's Swansea.
Swansea.
I mean, I'm not just saying that because of what will now follow, but I would have got all those right, which is sort of annoying, really, because I won't get all of these right.
We'll see, Daniel. How do you feel about 4 out of 5, Michael?
I'm disappointed with the Russell Martin because he was at MK Dons, wasn't he? And then he moved. I'm disappointed.
They might
be
in the championship next season.
You make it sound like you're disappointed with him for having had the temerity to move clubs without informing you.
Well, it would have been easier that way, yeah.
All right. Well, that's the bar set pretty high for a few people getting 4 out of 5 in their opening game this year. Duncan, I think, is the only other exponent of the 4 out of 5. But let's see what Daniel can do. Can he match that? Can he go even better? Daniel, your questions start thus. Question one. To which player does this career path belong? Envigado, Banfield, Porto, Monaco, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich on loan, Everton, Al Rayyan.
That's James Rodriguez.
It is James Rodriguez. You're on the board. Question two. Clarence Seedorf's most recent coaching job was with which African country?
Oh God, I should know that because of AFCON. It's Cameroon. It's the hosts.
It's correct. Mm. 2 for 2. Question three. From which English team did Inter sign Robbie Keane?
Oh. Jeez. Coventry?
Is correct, ladies and gentlemen. Ooh. Question four, Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
What do the European Cup or Champions League finals of 1963, 1968, 1971, 1978, 1992, 2011 and 2013 have in common? I'll give you the list again. 63, 68, 71, 78, 92, 2011 and 2013.
Were they all played in England? Do I need more than that? 68
yeah.
was at Wembley, 92 was at Wembley. Were they all at Wembley?
They were all staged at Wembley. I think we're level on four
M-Cox,
correct answers each. And you have a fifth question still to answer. And given the symmetry of this quiz format, it is a championship question.
Yeah.
Oh,
let's
gosh.
See how you do with question five. This is huge. Neil Critchley is the manager of which championship club?
Blackpool.
It's correct. Daniel's story, 5 out of 5. You are through to the quarterfinals. Michael Cox is out of the competition.
Who falls? Cox falls.
He's right about the seeding as well, by the way.
Well, Michael, any reaction?
Disappointed the one I got wrong because, yeah, I did. But I didn't know it because I said the wrong answer. But,
But any words for Daniel's performance against possibly the opponent he feared the most?
Well, I can't argue with 5 out of 5, and I'd probably Daniel and Charlie Eccleshare, I'd say, would be the two I'd least want to face. So, yeah, good luck to him for the rest of the competition.
Daniel, how do you feel? You were predicting a washout from questions.
I think the standard of questions for both of us felt slightly more gentle than they have been for other ones. I've been getting twos and threes and fours.
Yeah, same.
that was nice. Thank you to whoever compiled those.
Nick Miller.
Clarence Seedorf.
The shadowy question master.
Glory, glory, Daniel Story. We'll see you in the quarterfinals. And if, like Daniel, you reckon Gabrielle will score for Arsenal against Leicester on Sunday, you can get odds of 5-1 at PaddyPower.com and on the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only, and please gamble responsibly.
So we're going to have a new name on the Intertotally Cup this season. And we've got one more first round match to go, and it is Charlie Eccleshare up against James Horncastle. So that's a biggie. But that brings us to the end of today's Totally Football show. Daniel, thank you for stopping by. Congratulations on your win. To Duncan, to Tom, and to Michael, who's, I have to say, in shock right now. Michael?
I really am.
Yeah.
Did a Sammy Kafur, was just punching the ground of his rings. It's quite sad to see, actually, but...
They'll be next time. You'll come back stronger. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to producer Charlie as well, and you, listener, for doing the listening. And we're back Monday. Charlie Eccleshare, James Horncastle, and all the weekend's games, and a bit more Champions League previewing to be done. And who knows what other massive stories will happen in the meantime as well. Anyway, we'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.